What we've been doing on Tuesday nights for the last 3 or 4 weeks is to fill it, what I call filling in the blanks, or that is, there are the major things that we talk about on Sunday mornings. We talked about the Last Supper. We talked about Gethsemane and Christ's struggle there. We talked about the crucifixion and what they did to Christ during the trials. Those are the major events. And then we take a look on Tuesday nights on the little events that happened in between that. And we're going to continue that tonight to look at something that happened in between. And this is probably, of all the things that we have talked about, the least discussed. This is not often discussed, and some of this I've never really, I guess, heard discuss it. Even when you open the commentaries, they tend to skip over it. And so we're going to look at it and see if we can get a grasp of what's happening here, because there's nothing that's not fascinating. It's all very fascinating. And Dr. Luke, again, has excelled in telling this story, and others will jump in a little bit, but Dr. Luke will be the best one as he tells us what happened. And we're going to look today at the road to Calvary. The road to Calvary. What happened as Jesus went out to Calvary to be crucified? I want to talk first about the background of it, because it's very definitely a cultural background that we really need to understand, because when we read the story, if we don't, it's very easy to be confused a little bit about exactly what happened. So we want to fill in the cultural background here. And remember, it is Passover week. The last week of Christ's life is Passover. That's one of the, if not the highest holiday of the Jews. We've mentioned that before. And what it means is that there are two Sabbaths in that week, because they wanted each day to be special. So normally, the Sabbath would come Friday at sunset. That's the beginning of a Jewish day. Your day begins at sunrise. Theirs didn't. Theirs began at sunset. So normally Friday at sunset would be the Sabbath, and they would go through the day Saturday until Saturday sunset, and that would end the Sabbath. But they added a Sabbath day to that, so that Thursday at sunset was also a special day, a holy day, a Sabbath day, or a holiday for the Jews. And so Passover meals were to be eaten after sunset. And so what it does is it makes the clock different than you and I would normally do. If you're going to celebrate Christmas, you all gather around and, you know, in the morning or something, and eat a big lunch or dinner, and then that's, we're done with the day. But their day began at sunset. And so Thursday night, you know that Jesus planned ahead of time secretly that they were going to eat the Passover in Jerusalem, in a place that we call the upper room, that's been prepared and ready. It belongs to Mark, the one who wrote the Gospel of Mark. He is the owner somehow of that upper room. And so Thursday during the day, they prepare Passover, get it all set, and then when the sun sets Thursday, Jesus comes into town, goes in the upper room, and they have Passover together. So beginning at sunset, going in, take their time, just like you would on a holiday, enjoy the night with them, enjoy the night beginning at sunset, and go into the wee hours of the morning. And so Jesus was doing the same thing. Thursday, sunsets, he starts Passover with his disciples, and it would have gone into the wee hours of the morning, but he has an urgent desire to pray.
And so he stops ahead of time and goes around midnight out to Gethsemane and prays there for about 3 hours, we think. And so what's happening now? Think about the whole city of Jerusalem. The whole city is now finished at the temple. They've done all that they wanted to do at the temple, and they've now gone to their respective homes, respective places all over Jerusalem. Some people outside of Jerusalem, wherever they can. There's thousands of people now. There's not just a few. The population of Jerusalem would double and triple and even more for Passover. And so there's thousands of people, and they all go into their homes where they are going to sit quietly and enjoy Passover. Now, I remember when I was a kid, on Christmas Eve night, we had a snowstorm. There was 3 foot of snow. And when we got up Christmas Day, of course, we lived on the Sour Springs Road and a dirt road. We said, well, I wonder if the plow's coming. Plows didn't come. And we talked to the guys later, and they said, well, it's Christmas Day. We're all staying home. You don't care, you know. You all want to stay home. We're not going to plow the roads, get up and ruin Christmas. And so that kind of attitude is kind of what prevails in Jerusalem. Everybody's enjoying Passover. And so what that allows to happen, right? They're all in their homes after dark. They begin Passover. It's a very leisurely thing. And they want it to be leisurely because they're celebrating freedom, all right? Purpose of it is freedom. We are not slaves. We came out of Egypt and are free from slavery. We're not slaves, and so we recline on the couch like this. And they're all laying on the couches around, and it's very casual, and it can take as long as they want. So the general population, plus most all of the visitors, have gone to their home. They begin celebration of Passover. They lead it through into 2 or 3 in the morning, and they all go to sleep. Now, that makes for something. And when everybody's celebrating, Judas Iscariot goes to the leaders of the temple, and he said, I promised to turn them over. We can do it now. It's after dark. He had been in the upper room with Jesus. Jesus said, go do what you got to do. And Judas got up and went out. He goes straight to the temple. And to their surprise, I think, he says, we can do this tonight. I can lead you to him tonight. So if you come with me, I'll lead you to him. And I'm sure that Judas first went back to the upper room. Right? Because the Bible tells us that Mark, who owned the upper room, ran ahead to Gethsemane to warn Jesus that they were coming. And so I'm sure Judas says, first of all, we left them at the upper room. We'll go there. He goes there first. Now, who's watching? Nobody's watching. Everybody's inside celebrating, right? They're all having Passover. Nobody pays any attention. So here's a group of temple police and Jewish leaders with torches. All right, there's no street lights, right? Just torches. And they're walking through the streets. And they go outside up onto the Mount of Olives, arrest Jesus, and bring him back into town. And Judas thinks he's there in the upper room, goes there first. But all Jerusalem is sleeping. And so nobody knows what's going on. And so that's very much a part of what's about to happen here. In Luke 23, I want to explain to you, give you an idea of how it worked. You got the Mount of Olives here, and of course the Garden of Gethsemane is on the Mount of Olives.
And you come down the Mount of Olives into Jerusalem, and there's the Temple Mount. Mount Zion is here, and the temple enclosure. It's 27 acres. It's a big place. It's on the Mount Zion, all right? And built above it on purpose by the Romans is a fort, a fortress, Antonia. It's called a fortress. It's a Roman fortress.
Pilate is in that Roman fortress.
Now, as you go through town of Jerusalem in the streets, you come to Herod's palace. And Herod had a palace built by his father in Jerusalem, and he came and stayed there for Passover. And we think that if you went south in the city, down here was Caiaphas' house. Caiaphas' house. And so, let's follow it in our mind. From the temple, led by Judas Iscariot, and go through the streets, through the gates, up onto the Mount of Olives,
and they arrest Jesus.
They take him back to the house of Caiaphas.
In the house of Caiaphas, they put him on trial
by the Jewish Sanhedrin. They pronounce him worthy of death. They can't do anything about it. So they go back to Pilate at the Roman fortress and say, we want him crucified. He says, no. He says, you got to have a charge. So they end up, Pilate said, you got to take him to Herod if he's from Galilee. So now they come back through the streets again and go to Herod's palace
for the second trial.
Now he's going to go back because Herod said, oh, I'm not going to make any choice. He goes back again up to the Roman fortress, Gabbatha, where Pilate will give sentence. So they have walked four times leading Jesus through the main street of Jerusalem, which runs by the temple, and up to the Roman fortress. And they've come all the way through town to Herod's palace and then down to Caiaphas' house. They've been going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and nobody saw a thing. Everybody's celebrating. How did they get away with it? That was the plan, to do it at night, and so that nobody would know. And so it starts about 3 a.m. on the Mount of Olives, and by the time they go to Caiaphas' house, up to the Roman fortress, back to Herod's palace, back to the Roman fortress, it's somewhere around probably 8 a.m. when he's finally said,
go ahead, crucify him. So they have to prepare for a crucifixion. There's three of them. And so they take Jesus and whip him there before they go out to crucify him. They whip him. And usually what the soldiers like to do is whip people and get them weakened a little so that when they came to crucifixion, it didn't take so long. They sucked the life out of them with a whip. Now, it's about 9 o'clock.
And once again, they will come out of the Roman fortress, through the streets, past Herod's palace again. They will turn north on a main road that goes north out of the city. They go through the gates of Jerusalem, so they're outside the city now. And they come up north to this hill called Golgotha,
which means the skull. And if you've ever seen a good picture of it, it's just a big old rock hill. And when you look at, stand back in the right position, you look at that big old rock, there's two, not caves, but indentations in the rock. And so when you look like it, it looks like a skull. There's a big round rock hill with two indentations in the side. And you can still see them today. Louis's seen them there. And you go and you look, and you say, well, yeah, that's why it's called the skull. It looks like the skull. So, because Jerusalem is sleeping, celebrating first and then sleeping it off, all right, they're able to go back and forth and back and forth through the city with torches leading Jesus back and forth and back and forth. They get a conviction at 8. They prepare him by whipping him. It's 9 o'clock. It's time to go. And now people are just waking up. Right? People are just getting up, waking up, and coming out. And they realize some of the word begins to spread. By a few people, Jesus has been tried and been convicted. All right? And so the crowd begins to gather. And we have two events that happen. Luke 23, I'm going to start at verse 24. Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they required, or they want him crucified. He released unto them him that for sedition and murder was cast into prison, or he turned Barabbas loose, whom they had desired, but he delivered Jesus to their will. They wanted him crucified. And as they led him away, they laid hold upon one Simon, a Cyrenian, coming out of the country, that on him they laid the cross, that he might bear it after Jesus. And so the first thing as they're getting started down the road, down the blue line, they're coming down, Jesus is carrying his own cross beam. All right, you see pictures where he's carrying a whole cross, but that's not how they did it. The cross beam of the cross was what he would carry. And so they would begin this procession, and Jesus is going to carry in the beginning. And we got Luke. We'll just look at these so that we can show the difference here. John. John, the next gospel over, chapter 19. And verse 17. So we get the order right. And he, Jesus, bearing his cross, went forth to a place called the place of a skull, which is called in the Hebrew tongue Golgotha. So as they leave the Roman fortress where he's been turned over to the Roman soldiers now, he's carrying the cross beam of his cross. Now, he'd just been whipped with a cat of nine tails, that is a leather strap with nails in the end, mostly, and it's a pretty vicious thing. And his back is all cut and bloody, and they said, carry that beam out to your cross. And so, you know, remember, you know other things, right? You know other things. You know what happened at 3 a.m. before he was arrested. You know that he sweat blood, that under such an intense emotional weight, his nervous system set in motion and he sweat blood right there in Gethsemane. So he's already done that, which was enough to kill him. An angel was sent to give him strength. And somehow, whether it was food or what it was, we don't know. But the angel came and strengthened Jesus. Now he's got that extra strength. He gets whipped. They're trying to get it out of him. And now he's carrying that beam on that cross. In front of him is someone carrying a sign. All right? It's a capital punishment. And Pilate makes sure that everybody gets a sign as to why they're being crucified. It's a deterrent. Say, don't do that. Look what happened. All right. And they're carrying a sign in front of Jesus. Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Jesus puts the cross beam. We don't know how big it is, but it's probably pretty heavy. A pretty good sized beam. And he's carrying it along the road, and we're not sure exactly what happens. Now, it says Simon, a Cyrenian coming out of the country, is pressed, taken in by the Roman soldiers, and you, I want you to carry that cross. So he's coming this way, all right? He's coming into Jerusalem, Simon, into Jerusalem this way to do some Passover business, do a celebration, whatever reason he's coming into town. And he meets the crowd as they're coming along, and the Roman soldiers say, "Hey, you look like a strong fellow. You carried his cross." Now, did Jesus fall under the cross? We have generally assumed that. We don't know that for sure. He may have just simply been so exhausted by the whipping that he couldn't keep up with the pace that they wanted. But for some reason or another, they take Simon, who is a Cyrenian. Now, Cyrene is a city in Africa. And if you think about the map at that time, we get Rome over here in Greece, and we come around, and Jerusalem is here, and where it's all happening. And you go along the North African coast, you get to Egypt first, and then over here, what they call Libya. So it's past Egypt, into Libya, and the city of Cyrene is there. And so Simon is a Cyrenian. He comes from Africa. Libya, Africa. And so there's a good chance that he's a black man, because that's where he's from. And so there's something fascinating here. I want to look, and this is important. Mark recalls the same event, but he says something different. Mark chapter 15. Mark chapter 15. Here's the same event. Mark is going to tell us what had happened. Verse 20. Mark 15, verse 20. When they had mocked Jesus, they took off the purple from him, put his own clothes on him, and led him out to crucify him. And they compel one Simon, a Cyrenian, who passed by, coming out of the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. And so we're told that Simon was the father of two fellows, Alexander and Rufus. Now, why would they mention that? Here's a perfect stranger. He's totally uninvolved in it. He's got nothing to do with it. He's coming out of the country into Jerusalem for some, I'm sure, Passover celebration purpose. And they say, you look like a strong guy. Get over here and carry this cross. And Mark says who he was. He said, not only did I tell you he was Simon the Cyrenian, but his two sons were Alexander and Rufus. And you say, well, what does that matter? Well, think about it. Why would they identify him as the father of these two people? Why does Mark identify him? Why does Luke say he's Simon the Cyrenian? Because they know who these people are. The people, the general people, Mark himself, who was there, of course, was right there at the Last Supper and in Gethsemane as he ran to warn Jesus. He knows that that's what's that who these people are. And so he says, well, you know, Simon, his two boys, Alexander and Rufus. And so we try to figure out, well, who's Alexander and Rufus? Well, Alexander's a name that appears over and over and over and over and over and over again in the Bible. And so there's really not a way for us to tell exactly if any of those people are him. But in Romans chapter 16, We get a very fascinating comment here. Romans chapter 16. Paul is saying hello to his friends. And as he writes to the church in Rome, he says in verse 13, "Salute Rufus," there's the name, "chosen in the Lord, and his mother and mine." All right, and so he says, when you say hello, make sure you say hello to Rufus. Well, who's he? He's the son of Simon the Cyrenian. But that's not what's the most important. It says he's chosen by God. How come? Because his father accidentally happened to walk into town when Jesus was carrying his cross out to be crucified. And something happens there when Simon, who I'm sure against his will, has to carry the cross. He doesn't want to do that. He's out of his own business. So why does he have to carry the cross? Well, something happened that made it so that Jesus couldn't, or that just wasn't fast enough for the Romans. They wanted to get out of the streets because the streets are getting a little touchy. People are waking up and they're leading this man who hundreds of people went to listen to in the temple on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. They're leading him through the streets with a cross beam on his back and a sign in front of him that says he's going to be crucified because he claims to be the king of the Jews. They don't want to do that. They want to hurry. So whether that's exactly it or what happened, anyway, Simon, completely uninvolved, picks up the cross, and at that point, I'm sure he's at odds with these Roman soldiers. What are you doing? Leave me alone. Carry the cross. And he came under the influence of Jesus. So Jesus, weary, he's all bloody. Bible says he's been beaten to the point where you can't recognize him. His eyes are swollen. His face is all bruised. He's been beaten, all bloody all over him. And he's carrying his cross beam. And I'm sure when Simon picked the thing up, put it on his big, strong shoulders, Jesus said, "Oh, thank you. I want to thank you. I want to tell you how much it means to me what you just did. I want to be very grateful for what you just did." He came under the influence of Jesus on the road to Calvary, and it transformed his life to the point where they look at his son Rufus and what do they say? Well, he was chosen. What do you mean chosen? It was an accident, right? Nothing's an accident. You get Jesus involved, there's no accidents. Jesus is lining it up. And Simon comes in totally unaware. He's not searching for anything. He's not hungry for anything. Totally unaware. And there, watch this. He comes under the influence of Jesus, and he is so transformed by what he sees in Jesus' face and what he hears from his voice as he carries the cross for him. And remember, he's the only helper that Jesus got. When they were punching him in the face, when they were spitting on him, when they were whipping him, dragging him around, when they were doing all that to him, nobody lifted a finger. And now a perfect stranger from Africa is coming in, and he is the only person who will help Jesus, carries the crossbeam the rest of the way to Calvary. And I'm sure he's scratching his head looking at the sign. He knows it's criminal offense is supposed to be on the sign, and he reads it and it says, "Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews." What kind of offense is that? How can that be an offense? How can that be something wrong? The other guys, they're carrying a cross that says thief and murderer. Rebellious against Rome. They're carrying the signs that give their crime. His crime is that he's the king of the Jews. And so Simon is scratching his head and thinking, wow. And it becomes a great honor as he becomes the only helper to help Jesus, that whole situation. Nobody else helped him except for that one man. And so on the road to Calvary, we have the transforming power we talked about Sunday, the drawing power of Jesus as he is himself. And the thing that you always remember is when he stands on a cross and turns to the thief and says, today you'll be with me in paradise. You understand, he's nailed to a cross. He's being tortured to death. That's what the cross is. It's to torture you to death. He's being tortured and he ignores the pain. Even to the point where the women there say, we brought this concoction and it's meant to dull the pain, and we give it to you so you can stand crucifixion. And he said he tasted it and turned his head. I don't want any. He refused the painkillers. So his pain is more intense than most pain, but he comes absolutely above the pain and reaches out first to Simon the Cyrenian and to others as he's on the cross. And so there's no chance meeting with Jesus. And so we see kind of a unique situation. Number one, we got a cross carrier, and that's Simon. Number two, you got a crucified one on a cross, on his own cross, and that's the thief. And then the third thing you get is the crucifier himself, and that's the Roman soldier who actually helped crucify Jesus, and he also turns to Jesus. And so we get three people involved in the crucifixion. Simon the Cyrenian carries Jesus' cross. He becomes a follower of Jesus. The thief on the cross crucified with him, he becomes a follower of Jesus. And then the crucifier, the Roman centurion, who when Jesus died said, surely that was the Son of God. That was a righteous man. And he comes over to Jesus' side. So on the road to Calvary, this black man comes and is chosen by God. And his sons become famous in the church as being specifically chosen by God because of a chance meeting. No such thing, okay. But it looked like a chance meeting of Jesus on the road to Calvary. So even on the road to Calvary, he's powerful. And Jesus struggles in the Garden of Gethsemane. When he comes up out of that struggle, they come to arrest him. And he says, I am, and they all fall over backwards. Oh, yeah. Don't confuse. He's in charge. He's in charge. He's completely in charge. He says to Pilate, and Pilate says, don't you know I got power over you? He says, you wouldn't have any power if I didn't give it to you. He's in charge. He's in charge. He knows what's going on. So let's see what else happens along the road. All right. We're back in Luke 23, verse number 27. Now, because it's a little past 9 o'clock and they're going right through town with him, coming right through town, there's people who are probably looking out, seeing it. The news is spreading, and they're coming to the road that leads to Calvary, and there's a group of people. Here we go. Verse 27, Luke 23. And there followed him a great company of people and of women, which also bewailed and lamented him. And so there comes the regular population, not the Jewish leaders, but the regular population are waking up now. It's 9 a.m. and they're coming out to the road where Jesus is walking by. And a whole group of ladies start to cry, wailing and weeping, Jewish style, which would be very loud. And they're following him along the road. Verse 28. Jesus, turning unto them, said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, weep not for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children." All right? They're crying because they're taking Jesus away, and they know what's going to happen. And he says, "Don't weep for me. You need to weep for yourself." Here's why. "For behold, the days are coming which they shall say, 'Blessed are the barren, and the wombs that never bear, and the paps which never gave suck.'" Or in other words, it'll be a happy day if people don't have children that's coming. You really don't want to have children if you're going to be in these days. "Then shall they begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.'" All right, so in other words, he says, there's a day coming for you, and I want you to be much more concerned about that than this. And well, I'm concerned about that, and that's a day coming when Jerusalem is going to fall to the Roman army. 40 years later, after Jesus, the Roman army comes to Jerusalem, and they tore that place apart. They really got angry, very angry over what was happening. And Jerusalem had been laid siege to, and they had really given the Romans a run for their money. So finally, the Romans would break in. Now, Jesus talked about it here. He said, it'll be better if you don't have children when that day comes. It'd be better now. And people are going to say, "Please, let the mountains fall on us and bury us alive. That'd be better than what we're going through." Right? Now, Jesus warns about it all week long. He's been talking about this. In Luke chapter number 19, if we go back there, Luke chapter number 19, in verse number 41. This was on Palm Sunday. He's riding, we explained it to you, coming over the crest of Mount of Olives, looking down at the city. "And when he was come near, he beheld the city and wept over it," verse 41, "saying, 'If thou hast known, even thou at least in this thy day, the things which belong to thy peace, but now they are hid from thine eyes. For the day shall come upon thee, thine enemies shall cast a trench about thee, compass thee round, keep thee in on every side, and shall lay thee even with the ground, and thy children within thee. They shall not leave in thee one stone upon another, because thou knewest not the time of thy visitation.'" He said, "I'm coming to you. I'll be happy to be your king." They said, "We don't want you to be our king." And he said, "It's a sad thing, because they're going to lay this place to the ground. And when they tear it down and it's all laying in the dust, your dead children will be laying all over in the street." And so Jesus says to the women gathered on the road to Calvary, "It'd be better if you didn't have children when that day comes." Right. How bad does it get? Oh, it gets bad. In Matthew 28, that doesn't sound right. Matthew 24, that sounds better. Can't read my own writing sometimes. Matthew 24. He's in the temple on either Monday or Tuesday of that week. All right. So Sunday, Palm Sunday, he tells them, "They're going to lay this thing, and your dead children are going to be laying among the stones." And on Tuesday or so of that week, he gives this information, verse 15. When you therefore shall see, chapter 24 of Matthew, the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. Whosoever readeth, let him understand. And let them be in Judea flee into the mountains. Let them which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Neither let him which is in the field return back to his clothes. Whatever you do, stay out of Jerusalem. And woe to them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. Pray ye that your flight not be in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. And so he says, there's a day coming. And what happened, of course, the Romans came in, and when they finally broke through the walls of Jerusalem, they were really, really angry. And the captain of that army, he said, boys, you know, we kind of got to, now they said, we're going to fix this place. And so we know they killed the children, left them laying in the streets. They went into the temple and tore down the walls. Well, they got so angry that they said, we're digging up the foundation stone so that this will never be able to be rebuilt. And the Roman soldiers dug out the foundation stones of the walls of the temple and laid them in piles there, which was extreme. The captain went in there first, and he hung up a pig in the temple. You know that pork, pigs were unclean animals. Jews didn't even own them, weren't allowed to even own them, especially eat them. And here they got a pig, dead pig, hanging up in the temple. All right. How bad did it get? It said that they crucified the Jews until there was no more wood to make crosses. That is, they cut down trees and they used trees and they crucified people on trees all over around Jerusalem until finally they crucified so many people that there's no wood left to make any crosses. So Jesus is telling the ladies, look, ladies, I'm telling you. And they reject. And what he says, if we look back, he says, back in Luke 23, verse 31, for if they do these things in a green tree, what shall be done in the dry? Or he says, me, I'm a green tree. I'm alive. I'm able to stand. I have done all things well. I am God's representative, and they're taking me out and crucifying me to a cross. And you try to light the green tree on fire, and it just doesn't want to burn. All right? He says, so they're trying to light me, destroy me, burn me up, get rid of me. He says, well, if they use that kind of hatred against the green tree, what will happen when they light a dead tree on fire? And Jerusalem, and particularly the temple, was a dead tree. There was nothing in it, no life in it. All right? The spiritual life in the temple was gone. It had gone out. It was all just show. And so Jesus said, if they do this to me, what will the Romans do to you? And so Jesus looks patriotic. And people call him patriotic. And I don't say that he wasn't, but I say most of all is that he loved people. He loved people. So Jesus, still very much disturbed, he's been talking about it through the week, what's coming. Because you have rejected me, what's coming for you is some really bad things, and I love you people. And when he sees the women there, he responds to their sorrow. They're wailing and crying for him, and he says, oh, come on, you're going to have it much worse. Don't cry for me. And so Jesus has a great following among the women in Jerusalem. Now, the thing about it is that women in that society were normally ignored. and placed lower than most anybody else. If you were married to a rabbi, you never walked next side of him in public, ever. You always walked behind somewhere. You made sure that your presence wasn't felt with the rabbi. He don't want you walking next to him. And so women had this position in Israel, particularly among the Jewish leadership, that they are almost rejects completely. They're on some lower level. Along comes Jesus, who embraces women as equals. He takes them into his heart as equals. And we always remember and don't ever forget what it says in Galatians. It's an important thing. Galatians, I'm looking at chapter 3 and verse number 26. For you are all children of God by faith in Christ Jesus. Equal. As many as you have been baptized into Christ have put in on Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, neither bond nor free, neither male nor female, for you're all one in Christ Jesus. So the Bible says that in Jesus' eyes you are individuals. So women who were ignored and spurned in that society embrace Jesus because he treats them very well. And God sees us as individuals. And so women respond to Jesus for his treatment of them, and it becomes a great honor to them. And now they are gathering alongside of the road as he's going to Calvary, and they're crying for Jesus, and the men, Jewish leaders, who are walking along, got a vicious grin on their face. We got him. They're going to get rid of him. But the ladies are on the side of the road crying. I think one of the things is that because of the lower place that they were given in society, pride is not so much a problem. Pride is not so much a problem. So women come gathering to Jesus. Now, just think of it for a minute. In the Old Testament, there are women who are mentioned here and there throughout the Old Testament. You got Hannah, the mother of Samuel. You got Rahab the harlot, who believes in Jesus. You got Ruth, becomes a great-grandmother of King David. Esther, the queen, who saves the whole Jewish race. Rachel, the mother of Jacob's two favorites. Deborah, who fights the battles in Judges, and Miriam, who's a leader, along with her brother Moses and Aaron. And there are ladies mentioned throughout the Old Testament. But when you get to Jesus, and you come to Jesus, there's whole crowds of them. He's walking the road to Calvary, and there's a big crowd of women wailing and crying. And he responds to them. You get him on the cross. He's now nailed to the cross. Where's his disciples? They're all gone. Only one comes to the cross, and that's John. Who's at the cross? Women. The women are gathered at the cross. And the women have come to be at the cross. And then when Jesus dies, they take him down to bury him. Who goes? The women go. The women are gathered at the tomb as he's being buried, watching and seeing where it is. And then on Easter Sunday, who leads the way? Women. Women are leading on the road to Calvary. They're leading at the cross. They're leading at the burial of Christ. And they are leading at the resurrection. Women become leaders in faith over men throughout the life, particularly in this week of Christ, starting by the road to Calvary. And so he's had a profound effect on the women. Now, the hatred against Jesus was so intense. He said, they're trying to burn a green tree, and I'm worried for you. He's a sinless Son of God, and they're actually going to get him crucified. What's going to happen to you poor ladies when a dead tree gets lit on fire, when the Romans come and destroy Jerusalem? And so he gives a warning there on the side of the road. It's going to be intense. You're going to wish you never had children. And he said, you would rather pray that Mount Zion falls over and buries you alive than go through what you're about to go through, where they crucify you until there's not any wood left to make crosses. And so it's a very moving part of the story of Christ just walking to the road, walking down the road. And as the daylight comes, the people gather, women become a particularly tender voice as he's walking to Calvary. And so Jesus on the road to Calvary shows two things. He needs good, strong men to stand up with him. He needs men to be men and grab a hold of a cross and carry it if that's what we got to do. And God's given us cross. The Bible says we all have a cross to bear. Put it on your shoulder and carry it. And don't be a sissy about it. Get a hold of the thing and carry it. Look it in the eye. Do what you have to do. All right? Don't fade back. And Simon the Cyrenian picked up that cross and carried it. And his children were called chosen ones because he carried the cross for Jesus. And then God needs women of faith, too, who will believe on him no matter what and won't abandon him in any cause. Not on the road to Calvary, not crucified on the cross, not buried in a tomb, and not dead 3 days. No matter what, they will be faithful. And so it shows the people who stand out in the story of Christ. And the reason they only show up at this time is because the darkness has been a cover. And they've been leading Jesus back and forth through the streets all night long. And nobody was awake to see it. All right? So not till the morning comes does the crowd gather and go out to Calvary. And when the people are watching, they're listening to the Romans make fun of Jesus. But the Jewish leaders are there just loving it. He's on the cross. Come down. Show us what you got. Let's see what you got now. If you're the Son of God, come down. And they're shouting all kinds of things at him. And the people, finally, when it turns dark, everybody kind of gets a sick feeling. Like, whoops. Why is the sun gone at 12 noon? Something's not right here. And so the Jewish leaders shut their mouth and go back, most of them. And the people are there. And it says he died on the cross. And it says they went back to Jerusalem, the regular people who had been sleeping in the early hours, and come to the cross as Jesus is led through the streets for the last time. They've been sleeping and come to the cross, and as they watch, when they're done, they see he dies. It says they went back beating their breasts. Or in other words, this is what we do when we really think this is not good. And the regular people, says, went home beating their breasts, a sign of public dismay and amazement and sadness, on the sad side of amazement, as they walk home from Calvary. Right? So that's the picture painted, what Jesus did, just going to the cross, just going there. He's in command. Turned Simon, an African into a follower, and his sons take a place of honor, and the women take a place of honor as they refuse to leave him throughout the whole event. All right? So those are some of the blanks that we fill in between the trial of Christ and the crucifixion. It's only a few verses, but it's a wonderful story of what happened in Jerusalem on that morning. Thank you.